Hello, and welcome to episode 3.12, the March 6th, 2024, Spring Ahead edition of Notes from the Aisle Seat, the podcast that covers the arts in Northern Chautauqua County, sponsored by the 1891 Fredonia Opera House. My name is Tom Lachlan, and I'm your host as we bring you news and information about arts events at the Opera House and around the region, including interviews with artists and creators across the county. I don't know that I want to wade into the very controversial topic of turning the clocks forward and back twice a year. I mean, it's a well-meaning process, but it does have its inconveniences on both ends. I have to admit that I find the return to standard time in the fall a little more jarring to my system with that sudden evening darkness, and I do enjoy the longer summer evenings. But no matter whether you use standard or daylight time, you're still only going to get 15 hours of sunlight in the summer and about 9 hours of sunlight in the winter, so I think the best option is to make use of the hours that you get. The sun doesn't care what time you think it is, only how bright it can shine on you. The 2023-24 season at the Metropolitan Opera House has been, if nothing else, a season full of innovation. With its next opera, La Forza del Destino by Giuseppe Verdi, the Met once again looks to modernize the opera, placing it in a contemporary, abstract setting. I spoke with Dr. Robert Strauss from the School of Music, and we discussed this attempt by the Met to make their operas more relevant to the present. Once again, I have with me Dr. Robert Strauss, one of my absolute favorite guests to come on to the podcast. Rob is on the voice faculty of the School of Music at SUNY Fredonia, and he is an opera aficionado par excellence. Always love to hear his insights. So, Rob, welcome once again to the podcast.
You are so kind to me. I'm grateful to be here.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for coming. We have in front of us something that in my research and looking into it and getting ready to talk about it on the podcast, I just came away blown away in a sense because it's monumental. La Forza del Destino by Giuseppe Verdi. And I had heard of the title before. I knew of the title, but as I dug into it, this scope to me was astounding. Can we start with that and get your kind of overall view of what this opera is in terms of its place in the canon?
Well, I will do my absolute best. It is sprawling, the scope of it. I feel, you know, in reviewing what I knew about it, certainly Verdi has written or wrote so many great, great operas that we know, La Traviata, Rigoletto, Otello, Aida, Falstaff. And so I knew Forza del Destino, certainly, but his other works I know more. I feel like at this point in his career, he was able to pick and choose a little bit more what stories he wanted to tell and how he wanted to tell them. And so I think this story gave him the opportunity to, you know, pull out all the stops, all of the bells and whistles, as far as that goes. And it turned into a four-hour opera.
Yes, a four-hour opera. One of the things I have to caution the listeners, if they go to, you know, see and listen to the Live at the Met performance on March 9th, Saturday, March 9th, first of all, it's going to begin at 12 noon, so that's an hour earlier than it usually does, and that's because it's going to last almost 4 hours. So right. I want
but
people
there
to...
will be potty breaks. There will
yeah,
be.
There will. There's two intermissions,
Yeah.
so so that's okay. The opera that the Met has done with this production, what it seems to want to do with a lot of productions in this season, and also as I glanced at next season, and that is modernize them. So this one has a sort of a semi-contemporary setting, I would call it.
Right.
Yeah, it takes place in modern times, but there's no real geographical locale. There's no real, place that you can identify beyond knowing where Verdi originally placed these. And I think that that's kind of interesting that they continue to do that. They did that with the Don Giovanni. They did that with a couple of other things. So the look should be kind of interesting.
Yeah, I think it is. I'm fascinated by it because certainly, I should start with a compliment. The Met does this really well. The Met does this really well. But certainly, I've seen productions of anything where someone decides, okay, we're going to set it in Philadelphia in 1972, and the story doesn't seem to work that way. That it's just all about a gimmick. But I do feel like as I reviewed the plot, the issues of being an outsider from a different country and being discriminated against, the issues of the limits of being a female in a society that maybe doesn't respect females as they should, the idea of being in the wrong class, finding a romantic partner who is your who's good enough for you and that your family thinks is good enough for you. Certainly those they're not necessarily the major themes of the opera, but they do run throughout. And I think we still struggle with that today. So I do think that that translates. And with a director who's better than I am, and I imagine they're hiring directors who are better than I am, that it really can bring home to an audience what the message of it was, what the real message that still relates to us in 2024. And that, I was thinking about when stories are told well that relate to me, then I can sit for 6 hours, 8 hours, and binge watch something. So, I'm interested in that.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be interesting too. I said I wasn't going to try and recap the entire story, and I'm not. But I think you bring up a couple of points that maybe the listeners would be interested in knowing, and that's that the lead character Don Alvaro, who's the tenor, is in love with Leonora, who is the daughter of the Marchese. The father doesn't approve of him because he has Incan blood in him from Peru. And in a meeting between the three of them, the daughter, her suitor, Don Alvaro, and the father, Don Alvaro actually says, "Okay, I guess I was going to elope with your daughter, but I'm not. I won't do that. I will respect you." He goes to throw his gun down to surrender to the father. It goes off accidentally, kills the father, and then things just happen. Yeah.
Exactly.
And again, I won't go into that, but Leonora goes away, Don Alvaro goes away, Leonora's brother Don Carlos swears revenge for the death of his father and the disgrace of his sister, and it goes to Spain, it goes to Italy, it's all over the map. But I got an interesting metaphor, and I want to see what you think about this. I
Okay.
actually did read this, I think from the director, that the opening act, the incident that happens, is like when you take when you start to play pool, and you take the cue ball and you smack it into the triangle of balls that are in front of you, and that one impact all of a sudden scatters the balls all over the table, and you sort of have to then begin to pick each ball and put it in the pocket. They said that the death of the father is exactly the same thing. It's that
Yeah.
cue ball hitting the breath of the man, and everything scatters.
Well, it is that's a wonderful metaphor for the story, and also, I mean, the title is The Force of Destiny, and it's implying that, once an event happens, you can't get away from the result,
Right.
even if it's 4 hours later.
No. Or in the opera's case, in terms of time, I mean, I don't even know how much time it takes. Years go by.
I think so.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that's fascinating. And in a way, we haven't talked yet about, and maybe you're going to ask, one of the things that Verdi does in this opera that is a little unique for his operas, I would say, and for the time period, is that there's sort of a theme song that runs throughout.
That was going to be my next question. You got it,
Yeah,
Brian.
I mean, I know you do research, and I wasn't trying to,
Oh, no.
but
Absolutely.
you know,
This is an important point for the opera. There's a theme song
yeah, and
which.
it ties it all together, but just it's insidious and it's persistent and just iconic. I remember one of the reasons I know about Forza, or first learned about Forza, was because of this in undergraduate music history classes. Like, look what this composer did, and that this theme, and that happens in movies all the time, right? That it tells us how to feel if a certain character is going to arrive, or if the something tragic's going to happen, or a love theme, something great is going to happen. The music starts to play underneath that maybe we as an audience don't notice, and I think this is maybe not an early example of it, but certainly a strong example in Verdi's music of this. Just, and it's so incredible. One of the first things that I learned or heard from it was the soprano's aria in the fourth act, the Pace Pace, that starts with this theme again. And just by the way, the fact that the soprano in the fourth act of this opera has to sing this beautiful, spinning, luscious, luxurious aria. I mean, as a singer, I imagine by act two, I'm exhausted. Can I just take a nap? And yet my big moment is two acts later.
2 acts later, I mean, you have to sit in your dressing room for a half an hour and keep yourself warmed up. And the minute you walk on the stage, you've got this incredible aria.
Yeah, ba-da-da.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
It's really going to be. It really is something. So here's another question that I wanted to ask you because I found this fascinating, and I don't know what to make of it. Maybe you don't either, but we'll explore it. There isn't a love duet in this opera.
Oh, you're right.
There's never a moment where Don Alvaro and Leonora actually have some kind of love duet. But at the same time, there are three duets between Don Alvaro and Don Carlo when they confront each other in various acts. What do you make of that? Anything?
Well, off the top of my head, I want to do some more research, and so please, anybody who's listening, don't try to take away my doctorate for saying anything silly. But I wonder if that's part of, as I said earlier, Verdi, Giuseppe Verdi, he was at this point fairly famous as a composer, as an opera composer, and seemed to be picking and choosing what he would write. And so perhaps that has something to do with he felt like that a love duet, while lovely, may not move the story forward as much. And frankly, they're not together that much. There's a lot of missing each other and hearing stories of each other while they're on the lam or in disguise, or on the lam and in disguise, as far as that goes. So part of it is just not wanting to, this is the story that's being told, and so they're not on stage. They are on stage together, of course, in the first act, fourth
In the
act.
first act, they are, yeah, but it's
Yeah,
that's the.
they absolutely are, and there could have been, but maybe he just felt like that's gonna slow down the action, slow down the storytelling. We already get it, and perhaps, again, still off the top of my head, and I don't want to put words in Verdi's mouth. He's also not alive, so that's bizarre. But maybe it was about these two people. The force of destiny says they're not to be together.
Exactly. That was going to be my theory that
And
the
so if we
force.
sing a duet together, it's like, oh, these two should be together. And it's
Right.
sort of betraying what the point is. But again, I don't
Right.
know. It is a fascinating point.
Yeah, it's a fascinating point. And then finally, when everybody comes together at the end for the final tragic moment, there were two endings, by the way. We get the second ending, but the first ending was a little bit more tragic in the.
Do you suppose, I'm sorry, it's just a conversation now, but do you suppose that it was changed because it's hard to stage?
So that the audience is clear, the first ending that Verdi wrote was Don Alvaro in despair falls, plunges himself off a cliff and dies. So everybody dies at the end. Leonora dies, Don Carlo dies, and Don Alvaro dies. But Verdi got a second ending, and He lives at the end of that. He does not die. He lives with his destiny, as it were. But yeah, it's hard to stage somebody jumping off a cliff. I mean, yeah, I couldn't get a I couldn't get a read on why he changed the ending per
I don't
se,
know.
you
You
know.
know, what just popped in my head is Romeo and Juliet versus West Side Story. It's kind of nothing wrong with Romeo and Juliet. Please don't think that I'm saying that. But since West Side Story is based on Romeo and Juliet, and but Maria lives, and that is almost more tragic.
Yes.
Way. So maybe it has something to do with that he has to live with what fate has dealt him.
Yes, perhaps. I think that's the case. I really do. As a tenor yourself, what do you
Sure.
see those difficulties in Don Alvaro's score, what he has to sing? It's some pretty wild stuff in there.
Well, it all is, and thanks for asking that way. For sure, this isn't repertoire I would sing. My voice is too light for it. So the first thing that I would say, looking at it, is, "Darn, I wish my voice was bigger or thicker in the middle, because the orchestra's so big." But those are the demands are that the orchestra's big, that the voice has to be thick and rich and velvety, or whatever terms you want to use for it. But I think also the fact that it's so dramatic the whole time. I mean, that's sort of a difficulty for a singer, but more so as the actor is you have to pace yourself.
We got some pretty good talent coming up here, but one of the things I think is most interesting is the soprano Lise Davidson. This is actually her first Leonora ever. In the it's her Met debut in the role, and I also understand I think it's her first Italian opera as well. So
Interesting. Yeah.
she's getting a big break here after doing a couple of other things, Arianna Auf Naxos and a couple of other things for the Met. So
Yeah.
that should be a pretty striking. I think the other names that are involved, I don't know that I'm pronouncing this his name right, but Brian Jagda, is that correct? He seems like a nice, burly, solid tenor in the role of Don Alvaro. Igor Golovatenko is Don Carlo, it's actually not that big a cast, but the men's chorus for some of the scenes that take place in the monastery. Verdi has some of this beautiful music in there, by the way, that just sounds like praying. When
Well,
everybody starts to sing it, it just sounds like a prayer going up.
I mean, that's the thing. From early on, his work for the ensemble. I mean, the chorus from Nabucco, one of his earliest operas, the Va Pensiero, that's so famous. It's just gorgeous, gorgeous music, and the way they use it. And in talking about the talent in it in general, I just want to say I'm really, as we're talking about modernizing the productions, and we've talked in recent interviews about the new works that they're premiering, they're really finding ways, I think, to connect with today's audience and connect with us as people, to understand the works as not just archetypes or historical pieces, but as something that lives and breathes. And so I think they're also doing a really good job of in finding artists who are not just incredible singers, but really great storytellers as well. The most beautiful voice in the world, I will be impressed and astounded for 4 minutes, but probably not for 4 hours. So the most incredible, beautiful voice that is also helping to tell the story and being evocative and colorful and beautiful, and again, bringing Verdi's music to life and bringing the story to life in a way that an audience in 2024 understands is wonderful.
I think audiences are really going to have the opportunity to get the full impact with the modernization. They'll feel the story, they'll be able to follow the story, but and the singers are doing a great job of conveying this story. They're not just singing, they're telling you a story. And I think, even if you're going to sit there for 4 hours and listen to the story, you'll be captivated by it.
I agree.
Yeah. All right, Rob. Well, that's all the time I have for today. And again, I really want to thank you for always coming in and being ready to be on the podcast with me, talk about these great things. I think the Live at the Met is one of the best things actually that the 1891 Fredonia Opera House does. Would love to get more people to come out and see it because I am constantly have to keep in my head that you are seeing the one of the world's premier operatic venues come to tiny little Fredonia in with camera close-ups, interviews, beautiful, high quality, high definition audio and sound. I mean, I don't know how you beat that.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, we'll catch you the next time. We got more opera
Okay.
coming, Rob, so we'll catch you the next time. Thanks for your time once again.
Great, thank you.
The Live at the Met presentation of La Forza del Destino will be presented Saturday, March 9th, 2024, beginning at 12 noon. Tickets are $20 for adults, $18 for Opera House members, and $10 for students. Call the box office at 716-679-1891 for tickets and more information. Or, if you prefer, go online at www.fredopera.org/tickets. Live at the Met is underwritten with support from Daniel S. Kaufman and Timothy W. Beaver.
Ej tam gdzie zna czarny wody, siada na koń kozak młody, czule żegna się z dziewczyną, jeszcze czule z Ukrainą. Hej, 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 Sokoł!
Dunkirk has become a multicultural community with an interesting history, and it's been the mission of city historian Diane Andrasik to not only preserve that history, but bring it alive to audiences in the region through her writing and lecturing. She will be presenting the next in the ongoing series of lectures on Chautauqua County history entitled Dunkirk, Then and Now, Three Critical Streets. I spoke with Diane to get a preview of her lecture. Joining me now is Ms. Diane Andrasik. Diane is a retired teacher from the Dunkirk City Public School System, and she is now currently the city historian for the city of Dunkirk, and she's coming to the 1891 Fredonia Opera House on Thursday, March 14th, 7 o'clock p.m., to give one of our continuing lectures on Chautauqua County history. The lecture is entitled Dunkirk, Then and Now, Three Critical Streets. And Diane, want to welcome you into the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, our pleasure. You and I've lived in Dunkirk now myself for over 35 years, and the city is, you know, it's home to me now. And actually, a lot of times I become surprised at how long I've been here when I think about where I came from, which was Long Island, and the rest of my life. I've lived in Dunkirk longer than I've lived in any other place. And I found that when I discovered that, it was amazing to me because it's an interesting, fascinating, and varied city. And I assume you have discovered the same.
Yes, very much so. I've lived here my entire life. So, you know, that's 72 years. And so I find myself once in a while going back to even the last year I was teaching, how things have changed since then, just, for example, in the school system and how they've realigned things. And, you know, the more I've done research, the longer I've been involved with the museum and have gone through so many photographs and seeing buildings that I do know and buildings that I kind of remember, and then buildings that I never saw. It's amazing to see the change that way and to recognize there are things very familiar and there are things you think should be familiar. So it's kind of interesting.
Yes, and Dunkirk is one of those interesting places where people ask me where I live, and I give them the address or the various areas. They still tell me, "Oh, you live in the Therese House."
Yes.
Dunkirk is one of those cities.
Yeah, right. I understand that. Yes, indeed. Yeah.
You know, I've lived here for 35 years. I don't think anybody's ever going to call it the Lachlan House, but that's a whole other story. So let's talk about your new book. This is actually your second book, isn't it, on Dunkirk?
Yes. The first book was an Arcadia publishing book. The books everybody sees in various stores because it has that sepia-colored cover to them. I did that and finished that 2007, and it was published in 2008.
But let's drill into your lecture. You've actually now decided with your second book here to take a look just at three different streets and how they sort of tell the tale of Dunkirk. And let's take them one at a time. And without giving away too much of the lecture, because we do want people to come and listen to you. Let's talk about that. Let's start first with the one that most people are going to recognize, which is Central Avenue. What is it about Central Avenue that obviously helps form the character of the city?
Well, it was the first real street that went north-south because it started at the lake, at the mouth of the harbor, where anyone who was coming here could get the most easily. The first settler to the Dunkirk area, not specifically to the Dunkirk Harbor, he settled a little further west along the Canadaway, was Seth Cole. And he came in the middle of winter by ox-drawn sleigh with his wife and nine children, about to be nine. She gave birth here. And over the frozen lake, because there was no other way to come unless you wanted to just carry a knapsack or whatever they had in those days, because it was so heavily wooded that unless you had a pathway from one place to the next, you simply could not arrive here. So from that sprang the main road, the road that also connected us to Fredonia, though for a long time it too was mainly a path. That was some of the surprising things I found out. I always envisioned Dr. Fredonia, they just made a road, the first road, and that was not the case. It was a rather clogged up pathway for quite a while. And so that's why, while other streets fell back in importance, at least the north-south ones, this one retained its importance, and it just grew into what really, for all intents and purposes, is now the main street.
And it also became the heart of the city, in a sense, because most of the downtown Dunkirk is built around Central Avenue, with between 3rd and 5th Street being the locus of downtown.
Right, exactly. It was not always necessarily going to be that way, because we had Main Street, although at first it was not called Main Street. It was Lyon Street, and then it became Main Street. And that was really the Main Street, because it was where the train, where the railroad depot was located. So every day, hundreds of people came and went off the railroad line. And there were numerous hotels and boarding houses, and at least the east side of Main Street and mostly the west side of Main Street and a little bit of the east side had multiple stores, very important stores, and a bank, and all the kinds of things that made it important. But then, once the advancement of the train travel diminished, well, then that sort of became not as much populated and not as much visited, and its importance began to degrade until everything shifted more to Central Avenue.
Well, that was always one of the, when I first moved here, was always one of the mysteries to me for the first few years I lived here, was why Main Street wasn't really Main Street, in a sense,
Right.
After learning a little bit about the history, I understand it. But Main Street has an interesting character, because, as you say, it has, a number of important buildings around it. The CSX Depot is down at the foot of Main Street by the railroad tracks. But it gets to Maple Avenue, and then all of a sudden it splits, and Maple Avenue becomes, New York State Route 60, and Main Street becomes a residential street until it gets to, pretty much until it gets to the south end of town, and then just winds its way down to Vineyard Drive and pretty much terminates there. How did that split occur, or was that always natural?
Well, in part, I think because, though I'm not saying I know specifically, Central Avenue continued to develop. It began to push southwards, especially because for some of the people of substance, the area above 4th Street, especially, and more especially above 5th, became a little bit more of almost like a suburb of Dunkirk, where people of substance could have a very nice, humongous house and they could have a little land around it and trees. And it got them away from the hustle and bustle of what really was a rather industrialized city that in eras could be really rather dirty and industrial. And so things seemed to move that way. And so it extended outwards. Whereas with Main Street, and it may in part have been because, in fact, for both streets, all streets for quite a while, there was nothing but woods south of about 7th Street. I've read articles about how thick the woods were and up until a certain time when more and more of them were cut down for various reasons. It was that had more of the determination to keep it moving south. In my opinion, in large part because further south lay another town, namely Fredonia, whereas that was not the case over on Main Street. Main Street also had an area there to the east side of Maine, which had a lot of industry. And I think in terms of trying to keep movement going between various parts of the industry, the road just seemed to be pushed in that direction. It became more, as you said, houses of various kinds as you move straight south from Maine. But if you moved off onto that angle, you had access to some of the other places where there were different kinds of industry. And I think that's in part why that split happened.
Yeah, I could actually see that when you look at sort of like you look at a map of Dunkirk, you could see that almost that natural diversion.
Right, yeah. A large part of Brooks Locomotive Works was in that area, the Fourth Ward. And
yes.
And then the way the railroad line ran out of the city, it seemed as though Main Street almost was meant to parallel that as a more major road, because you weren't right necessarily next to the railroad line or necessarily right next to the Brooks Locomotive Works.
And your third street that you picked was Washington Avenue, which I found a kind of an interesting pick. I know that, you know, a couple of things that always intrigued me about Washington Avenue. Of course, the historical museum sits on Washington Avenue now.
Yes.
As well as the Jewish temple. Well, two very significant buildings. And so what was it about Washington Avenue that made you take an interest in that particular street?
Well, like a couple of the other north-south streets, it did have a dock. There were other activities that took place there, some of them industrial. And that's why if you look along the edges of Lakeshore Drive as you head up Washington Avenue, there really weren't many houses there because it was given over to the fishing industry and also to other types of industry, like the Mulholland Building was there. And so it was partially industrial. It was partially residential, but it also had a very important item that the city seemed to have wanted to have installed from the very beginning, which was a park, a public. I actually called it like a public square, although it was nowhere near the center of town. It may have been intended to have maybe been that at some point, but it just never developed in that direction. And so as the city became more industrialized and some people realized, hey, we need something of beauty in this town, so let's take that park area meant to be a park and turn it into a park. And for a long time, if you were going to live anywhere really within the boundaries of the city, not further up, as I said, up Central Avenue, further south, up above or below Fifth Street, the place to live was around Washington Park. Some of the best houses were there. The very wonderful Methodist Church, originally the church was going to be built on Central. And then land became available over on the corner of Washington. And the people who were building the church parishioners, purchased that land and gave up the Central Avenue land. And that said something, that people would look out upon some trees, and eventually it was made to be a little bit more advanced by having walkways put in and a fountain, and eventually the Neptune Fountain. And it was meant to be a place of beauty, a place of pride. And therefore, there were other north-south streets, for example, over on the west side of town, that had also, for example, as you started at the foot of the streets, the lake area had docks that were meant as fishing docks, almost primarily. So I could have picked one of those. But if you look up those streets, as soon as you get beyond Lakeshore Drive, they are almost always residential. The one, of course, has the, it was the Academy building and then became our preliminary high school until that moved over to 6th Street. But I felt that I had to include Washington for that reason.
Yeah, I think that I was, it was a pick I wasn't expecting, but the more I hear you explain about it and, you know, thinking about how, you know, the park is central to that area, I can understand why it was a significant street just in terms of talking about the days when, you know, Dunkirk was prosperous and had all these beautiful, beautiful houses.
Right.
You touch upon, I think you're going to touch upon a little bit of the, some of the, urban renewal of the late 70s. I'm not sure about that, but you probably have some knowledge of that and kind of what it did to those streets. Can you speak to that just a little bit?
What a lot of people don't understand is urban renewal was not an imposition. No one imposed that on the city. The government, federal government, did not say, here, you know, we're going to fix this city by removing these buildings and then things will be really wonderful. It was really something the city had choice in. And I think if there was to have been a mistake here, it was that they went overboard and didn't have enough thinking through of things, didn't have enough experts advising the city in such a way that they were made to slow down and you know, really rethink and reconsider and really plan in such a way that the really valuable buildings, as old as they were could be, might be salvageable and important, very historic. I mean, when I think of some of the 1860s buildings that were torn down, I mean, the old St. Mary's Church, now, of course, Elizabeth Ann Seton, is 1854, for God's sakes, 1854. And it's as vibrant as it always has been because people took care of it. And that's the key, that that could have happened with some of those other buildings, and that just did not happen. So I didn't go overboard in the book itself, because that's not really what the purpose was. It wasn't about, let's flagellate the city because people screwed up, and now, oh, woe is us, and you know, we'll cry about some of the buildings we lost and how empty the city can look. I wanted to just give them the ideas of what this city had, how vibrant it was, that ordinary people lived here and made their businesses, and then everything shifted, and we didn't know how to shift with it.
So I guess where I'd like to go with that sort of is now you've done a book about the overview of the history of the city. You've taken three of the streets now to sort of give us an idea of what the city was like and how those streets were important to its development. Are you at any point in time planning to take a time to write a book that will take a look at some of the individual buildings and their history? The Dunkirk Public Library has a wonderful history as a as an architectural marvel. Are you thinking about a book about talking about these individual beautiful buildings that we have in the city?
I am thinking what I really do need to do to finish the job is do a book of certain similar nature about the three east-west streets, which would be Lakeshore Drive, Route 5, 3rd Street, where the railroad ran, and then 4th Street, the least of the importance. So it would be almost like dealing a little bit with what happened with Washington. I spent the least amount of time on that in this book. So if I got the right kind of help and if I can find a grant that gives, there are grants out there for writing things. It's had me just sort of thinking about it this week. But I'll see what happens and whether I have enough in me to get that accomplished. So that is where I would rise. So then I would feel the job is done. We've got north, south, east, west, and it's not going to cover everything because not everything can fit, but it's a start.
Diane, I want to thank you for your time. Really interesting, just fascinating to talk to you as a resident of Dunkirk. Nice opportunity to talk to the city historian and get all this information. I appreciate it. And we'll look forward to seeing and hearing your lecture. You're a dynamic speaker, and I'm sure people are going to enjoy getting all this history. So thank you very much. And we'll see you at the Opera House on March 14th.
Thank you very much, Tom.
You're welcome. Dunkirk, Then and Now, Three Critical Streets, will be presented at the 1891 Fredonia Opera House on Thursday, March 14th, beginning at 7 p.m. Admission is free. Donations are gratefully accepted. Here is the arts calendar for the next 2 weeks in the region. The cinema series at the 1891 Opera House has a full slate of Oscar-nominated movies coming up. All of the cinema series screen on Saturdays and the following Tuesdays, beginning at 7:30 p.m. On March 9th and 12th, American Fiction, nominated for Best Picture and starring Jeffrey Wright, is Cord Jefferson's satirical look at our culture's obsession with reducing people to outrageous stereotypes. On March 16th and 19th, The Boy and the Heron, nominated for Best Animated Feature Film, is director Hayao Mizukawa's latest animated film and follows a young boy named Mahito and his heron guide on an epic fantasy journey. This series of films concludes on March 23rd and 26th with Perfect Days, a Wim Wenders film nominated for Best International Feature Film, starring Koji Yakusho as Hirayama, a toilet cleaner in Tokyo. Unexpected encounters reveal his deeply moving and poetic story. Tickets are sold at the door only on the night of the screening. A book of 10 tickets for $60 may be purchased at the door, online, or by calling the box office at 716-679-1891. The Opera House Cinema Series is sponsored by Lakeshore Savings Bank. Is Anything the Matter? The Drawings of Leila Ali continues in the Marian Art Gallery at the Rockefeller Art Center until April 14th. The artist will be on campus on Friday, March 22nd, to give a lecture on her work beginning at 4 p.m. in McEwen Hall 209. The Fredonia Concert Band will perform on Thursday, March 7th, in King Concert Hall beginning at 8 p.m. Admission is free. And finally, March is also Spring Musical Month at many area high schools, so I encourage you to go out and discover which schools are presenting what musicals and take advantage of the entertainment that the high schools in the region will be offering. And remember, if you have an arts event you'd like to get on the arts calendar, just call 716-679-1891 with your information or email to operahouse@fredopera.org and we'll include your event. Please give us a month's notice to ensure a timely mention.
I've always been tough, and you have to be tough to be this age and still work in the clubs. I don't want to have to try to convince people to like me. I know who I am. There's a young generation that is not tough. I could take the whole generation out with a jar of peanuts. Well, thank you. It's nice to see people actually laughing now. It's a hard time in this country. People are always saying, like, why do you think comics are having such a hard time? And really, you want to know why I think we are? Too many generations are alive at the same time. That's why. I'm not supposed to have to entertain all of you. Right? I'm supposed to pick a demographic and stay in my lane. But you guys want to come. There's so many. You got the greatest generations alive, baby boomer generations alive, Gen X, that's me, Gen Y, millennials, Zennial. Get the hell out of here. It's ridiculous. I'm not supposed to go do a show and you show up with your kids. Look around. Some of you are here with your children. I don't even know my mother's first name. It's not fair.
If I had only one word to describe Tammy Pescatelli, it would be survivor. Tammy has survived and even thrived in the difficult and challenging world of stand-up comedy for over 30 years now, and she remains as funny now as she ever was. It was great fun to talk to one of the hardest-working comedians in the business, as this interview will attest. Okay, those of you who are listening better get ready to laugh out loud, because with me now is Tammy Pescatelli. Tammy is coming to the 1891 Fredonia Opera House on Friday, March 22nd at 7:30 p.m. And based upon what I've seen on YouTube and her clips, she's one of the funniest people I've ever met. Tammy, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, you're so sweet. Thank you for saying that. I appreciate it. You don't get out much, apparently.
No, I'm too old to get out anymore. So, you know, I just stay here and record. I have to start off by letting you know that one of the things I've seen on many of your things, you are a comic who really gets into the different generations. And I'm one of those people who thought that, you know, airdropping pictures of men's genitals was in fact coming out of an airplane the minute you said that.
Well, that's my latest special, the last special was the Way After School special. And it's all on Prime now, because I also know my demographic wants free shipping. But I thought it was a good idea. It was in 2020, before anybody was really addressing the differences between baby boomers, Gen X, millennials, zennials, Gen Y, like, and now it seems like everybody is, but I feel like I kind of got there a little bit first.
Yes. I mean, I hadn't heard anybody talk about the span of generations in sort of in the manner that you do. And yet you do such great observational comedy. I know that the question I don't have to ask you is, where do you get all your material? Because all you say is, I wake up.
It's the truth. It really is. Like, when people get mad at me for jokes, I'm like, I'm sorry, I'm narrating my life.
So one of the questions that I did want to ask you was, you've been a stand-up comic now for really quite a long time. I don't want to say how long enough. And 30 years.
Yeah.
And one of your early appearances on the, you know, the Jay Leno show, your material was so different then from what it is now. And I just wanted to ask you, how do you think you've evolved as a stand-up comic from when you were younger to now?
Well, here's the thing. It was the same vein. I still spoke about my family, but my family looked different back then. At the time I became a comedian, I was 23 years old. So I was single. There was no children involved. So my stories were about my childhood, my grandparents growing up in the crazy Italian family. I talked about that a lot. People used to say, all she talks about is being Italian. And I used to actually take it as a compliment. I'm like, oh my God, they didn't realize I was a woman. Like, stuck by him. But then, you know, I grew up, I got married. I talked about my husband. I talked about his family. I had a kid. I don't really talk about my son because it's not his choice. I've told a couple jokes about him in this new hour that I'm doing, but they're really only to his credit. And he looks like a rock star in the jokes. But I just talk about like how I parent my husband. So it's just, what has the world changed around me? Has my perspective changed? That's what we talk about. But it's still the same, the basic family love craziness.
Yes. Yeah, I would have to agree with that. And I just want to let you know for the record that I'm married to a Sicilian. So
my apologies.
I could match you story for story, but I look at it from an outsider. You know, I have an outsider's perspective on it. It's even crazier when you're not Italian to watch what happens.
Yeah, well, and, you know, I'm Sicilian, but my husband's family is Moles. They're from Mola de Bari. So they literally have a whole different connotation. So it's the inbred Italian fighting.
You talk in your comedy, and you've been doing this actually for quite some time, if I get a feed on the time period, about being tough. You got to be tough. There's two phrases I've caught from your comedy. One is, you know, you got to be tough, and You have to know who you are. I've heard both of those phrases, no matter what year the clip is from, both of those phrases come out. Where did you come up with those particular catchphrases for yourself?
Well, it's not that those are catchphrases, because they don't add to my act. But I feel like if you have a platform, it is your responsibility to reach people, and you can actually do so much while someone is laughing. And my first half hour Comedy Central special was really my love letter to young girls. But a lot of women didn't want to hear it because they don't want to be told that they're acting classless or they don't have dignity. So I think sometimes that's how people get in trouble. But I can't change who I am. And I was always taught that, you know what, you have to toughen up. Life is tough, but you'll go through it. If your house is on fire, you have to get out. You might get burned when you're running through, but that's the only way to survive is to get to the other side of it. You have to, you just have to see that bad stuff happens to everybody, but only if you can understand that can you process it. So I would always say that because my father taught us that. My father was, you know, a kid from the wrong side of the tracks who football was his saving grace. His parents were immigrants. He was able to grow up and go to college on a football scholarship, and he worked hard. He played semi-pro. He played a little pro. He worked really hard. My mother was tough. Her mother died when she was 9. She did not have it easy. And we just, and I, by tough, I don't mean like you got to sit around and fight people and beat people up. I'm saying your fortitude, your spirit has to be that of a fighter. But I also grew up on Rocky movies. So there you go.
Very, very good. Very good. When you look at sort of the climate today, you don't do any political comedy. You don't get involved in that whatsoever. Is that a deliberate choice on your part?
Yeah, well, because there's enough, when you grow up in a crazy Italian family, there's enough fighting that has nothing to do with politics. I don't need political points of view to separate my family. I mean, you know, we don't need, and the fact is that there are people who do political commentary and political comedy 1,000 times better than me. It's not my wheelhouse. Mm. What I think in my personal life or whatever shouldn't have anything to do with politics, because no matter what you do, people are there to laugh, and I would alienate somebody with that. So I'm not good enough at it to try to think I could do it. I can talk about idiots, and that everybody can relate to.
That's a very good point. I mean, there's enough of them around. I hope you don't mind me asking this particular question, but I think it really, to me, when I was sort of trying to put the pieces of the puzzle together, really stood out, because you talk a lot about, you know, you have to be tough in the world, that you are an ovarian cancer survivor. And I was surprised to find this out, because it just sort of raised your profile even that much more in terms of how hard you've been working and the kinds of comedy that you do and your approach to life. Was that a significant influence in how you came to shape your own view of the world through your comedy?
Well, I'd love to tell you that it was and take all the credit, but that's not how it really was for me. My mother has had cancer 3 times. Ooh. She had ovarian, she had thyroid, she had breast cancer. Her battles with those, and some of the battles subsequently that I've seen in friends and family, one of my best friends, Jennifer, who lost her fight to cancer, those people changed. Mine was very simple. I, because of the family history I have, found out when I was early stage 1, they were able to remove it. I didn't have to do any follow-up. I only had a short amount of time to be fearful. So I almost hate that that's out in the zeitgeist, because I can't really take credit for that the way I see so many other men and women who fight that horrible disease, not ovarian cancer. Clearly men don't have that, but cancer in general, you know, but we all fight. Like I mean, I have fibromyalgia. I have just been diagnosed with something called sarcoidosis. That's a lung disease. but that doesn't mean my mortgage doesn't need paid. And that doesn't mean that I can lay down and I don't get to have medical leave because no one is paying my bills. If I don't show up to work, I don't have sick days. You know, no one can pick up my shift. So I think those are the things that help you keep moving forward, because forward motion is really what I think keeps people on track.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for that. I appreciate that. You've done a lot of different kinds of things. I mean, you've been all around. You've done reality television shows. You've done obviously Comedy Central and stuff like that. What haven't you done yet that you'd really like to do in the world of entertainment?
That's a great question. I mean, I just finished last year. I had a small part in a big feature film that's coming out this year with Vince Vaughn and Susan Sarandon and Lorraine Bracco and Drea de Matteis, like just amazing. And I'm so excited. I'm hoping they leave all my parts in on that. It's called Nona, so look for that. But I mean, I think I really want to be a regular, like on a TV series, and I'd love to play a cop. I'd love to play a cop on a TV series, just a little regular. I just think I think I would shine in that role. So if you know anybody.
I wish I did, but I think I saw somewhere, maybe in your media kit or someplace, you did do a little cameo for Blue Bloods.
I did. I sure did.
Yeah, that must have been a lot of fun. That show's been around for so long, and you know, it sort of has that vibe. I can kind of see you as a cop in that particular television series.
It was fun. Of course, I played a mob wife, but it was a really Donnie Wahlberg is a friend, and you know, I didn't tell him until I actually got the part that I got, because I didn't want anybody to say like it was favoritism or anything like that. But we didn't really get to hang out because it was COVID and they had so many rules. It was so bizarre. It was like doing nobody, you know, like everybody had to be separate. I barely met the director. I only saw the cameraman. It was just weird. I kept leaving my mask on and ruining takes. Like, it was horrible.
Oh, my. Oh, geez. Well, I know that I'm carving out just a little bit of your time. You're very busy. I think you're in Miami right now as I'm doing this interview.
Not Miami. I'm in the opposite side. I'm in Punta Gorda, Florida right now.
Yeah. And are you doing stand up around that area?
Yes, it's a great area. Port Charlotte. Mm-hmm. I come here every year for the past 15 years, and it's the most shows I do anywhere at any venue. I'm doing 5 shows and we're sold out 4 out of the 5 as we stand right now. And the 5th one is going to be at 9:30 on a Saturday. So I hope that'll sell out as well.
Great. Great. Well, I hope you have a lot of success with the rest of your tour. And when you come to the Opera House, you're going to hang out with Pete Coriale.
I love Pete. Pete and I go way back. We're both very good friends of Sebastian's, and yeah, mm-hmm. I hope so. You know, it's funny. I played the Opera House years and years ago before Pete moved there. And when he said he was moving there, I said, I know exactly where it is. And he goes, no, you don't. And I'm like, yeah, I do. And, you know, I don't live that far. I live in Northwestern PA. So I really only live an hour and a half. The greatest part about me being there at the Opera House is the people in that audience are like my friends and neighbors, basically, because I know the mentality. Everybody just is hardworking and wants to laugh, and I'm going to try to give them the very best show. What's exciting for me is the show that I'm working on right now is my new hour special. The only thing that I have to do is get it a little bit tighter, but it's an all new hour that I'm just honing until we film it. So it'll be fun. I can't wait till everybody gets to come out and laugh.
Oh, so we're going to get new material. We're going to see new material.
Yes, you absolutely will.
Oh, that's exciting. Now that's exciting. I always like the chance to get to see new material from people, and to have it at the Opera House, I think is really going to be pretty good. Yeah, I think we had Pete last March, about this time last March, and you know, he's just an absolutely wonderful guy, and I enjoy talking to him. And you know, if you and Pete get together, I would love to record that conversation, but that's a whole different story.
You, Matt, We once did a show, me, Pete, and Adam Ferrara, and I was like, this should be a tour, but no one got behind it.
Well, I think you can make it happen again. I think you can make it happen again. I'm going to hold out for that. All right, Tammy, I'm going to let you go. Thank you very much for your time. It was so appreciative, and I enjoy talking to you so much. And I'll look forward to having you come at the Opera House in about, I don't know, about 4 weeks from the time of this interview. So it should be a lot of fun.
That's right. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And thank you again for rearranging for me.
Hey, no problem. Anytime.
Have a good luck. Bye.
Tammy Pescatelli will be bringing her brand of comedy, including new material for her next one-hour special, on Friday, March 22nd at 7:30 p.m. Tickets are $25 for adults and $10 for students. These tickets are sure to go fast, so either go online at www.fredopera.org/tickets or call the box office at 716-679-1891 for your tickets now. And just a few reminders before we end this episode. Tickets for the final June 14th through 16th Bach and Beyond Festival are now on sale. Individual concert tickets are $20, but you can save $9 by buying a package for all three concerts for $51. There are also two pre-festival movies screening this year, Amadeus and Chevalier. A complete early bird package of the three concerts and two films is $61. Call the box office at 716-679-1891 for more information. Also, registration is now open for the 1891 Run for the Opera House. This year's 5K run or walk will take place on Sunday, April 28th, beginning at 9 a.m. Participants who register before April 15th will receive a T-shirt. You can find more information and a sign-up button by going to the 1891 Fredonia Opera House website at www.fredopera.org and clicking on the 1891 Run button at the top of the homepage. If you're coming to the Opera House for any upcoming events, remember it might be wise to dress a little more warmly than usual, even though the spring weather has hit, as the main boiler that provides our heat has gone offline and is in the process of being replaced. And of course, it's never too late to consider being a member of the Opera House. Check out our membership page on the website by going to the homepage at www.fredopera.org and clicking on the membership button. And that's it for this spring ahead edition of Notes from the Aisle Seat. My thanks to Dr. Robert Strauss, Diane Andrasik, and Tammy Pescatelli for being my guests on this episode. Notes from the Aisle Seat is a production of the 1891 Fredonia Opera House at Fredonia, New York. For more information on any of the Opera House's events, call the box office at 716-679-1891, visit the website at www.fredopera.org, or email at operahouse@fredopera.org. Notes from the Aisle Seat is now available wherever you get your podcasts and also on the Opera House YouTube channel. If you like this podcast, please consider following us by clicking the follow button on our home website at aisleseat.podbean.com and spreading the word through your social media feeds. If you have an arts event you'd like featured on the podcast, why don't you drop us a line at operahouse@fredopera.org, and we'll see about featuring your event. Please try to give us a month's advance notice if possible to facilitate timely scheduling. If you have any suggestions, comments, or criticisms of the podcast, just drop us a line at operahouse@fredopera.org. We'll be glad to receive your feedback. Our next episode will be available on Wednesday, March 20th, 2024. I'm Tom Laughlin, and until then, be safe out there, and be kind to one another.